Bombs began to fall, well behind the forwardmost line of engagement. Chapter 33. Carrier Defiant, Task Force RAF, Vega System. Latest update from the Explorer matches our jump calc, Admiral. Bombers inbound for Alpha Strike. Sulla studied the readiness display from his task force. The Omari was their lead combat ship, a Spallurzan battlecruiser that had seen action at Talai and the Battle of Shirawa. The capital ship was supported by two UW destroyer escorts, the largest ship the failing government could afford after production of her iconic supercarriers. But both the Isolde and Galahad had top-rated crews who'd faced pirate actions countless times. Combined with the support of the Espanian missile frigate Campeche, that was more than enough to knock out a lone savage hulk, provided they caught her in atmosphere, or at least it had been before. Normally fat and slow, the old light huggers the savages used, when caught before ramping up to their incredible sublight speeds, were easy pickings for even just an assault frigate so long as it was carrying the proper ordnance and the savages being pursued hadn't developed a means of staving them off with interceptors or other tricks. Following the Omari, Isolde, Galahad, and Campeche would be Sulla's own flagship, the Carrier Defiant, and her tiny escort group composed of the secondary assault frigate group and the defensive escorts Bauer and Jeanne d'Arc. All of this was simply overkill for a single savage light-hugging hulk. But this entire operation was supposed to be an exhibition, an example to show that even a planet as infected as New Vega could be saved instead of annihilated and made unusable by the growing confederation of post-Earth galactic worlds. So far, the Army was getting beat bad, but the Navy could come in and end this, which was what was about to happen on the other side of the micro-jump. But there was another objective, a secret mission that few knew about. Annihilating the savages to the point of non-existence was always the public goal, the declared goal. But there were bonuses obtained from within the flotsam of the wreckage of a burning savage hulk. Out there in the dark, the savages, once the best and brightest of Earth, had perfected technologies over the span of their long hauls, oftentimes producing results that strayed so far from the galactic evolution of technology that they were effectively wonders. Sulla had witnessed that much firsthand. Fantastic results. The stuff of miracles. The fabled longevity some of the savages were rumored to have, for instance, Sulla knew to be real. That particular technological breakthrough had escaped the savages' human descendants, as had other equally wonderful techs acquired within the occasional ruin of savage madness, or through interrogations on worlds the stellar charts had conveniently edited out of existence. UW's star might be fading, but the Navy and military-industrial complex that had ruled what was considered the core of the galaxy these last 200 years was not without teeth. And if all went well, if today went well, then maybe something new was on the horizon. A republic of stellar nations reaching all the way to the edge of the galaxy. Stand by for payload. Bomber's almost the target. Sulla unclenched his fists. Almost there, he told himself. Almost. The savages were a cause the various galactic nations could unite behind. Destroying them decisively would bind the worlds together. Today could be the beginning of a better thing the galaxy had never known. A galactic republic that would bring peace and prosperity to all. A combined force, a true coalition of nations, coming together to defeat a savage hulk that had managed to ruin a premier world, and then that world coming back online in the next few years as every nation lent a hand to rebuild, that would be the argument to band together. That would be the example, the lesson. Working together to achieve great things. They would show all that not only could it be done, but that it was vital to do so. Today, they would make that argument. Yes, thought Sulla. They will see. Chapter 34. Dropped from the Indomitable, the massive B-500 Titans came in low across the ocean, out in the waters beyond New Vegas City's eastern and southern shores, then started their climb to pick up altitude as they crossed over the cliffs that lined the coastline to the east of the city. The 538th Interceptor Squadron, Phantoms, streaked ahead to clear the target of AA fire and ground fire, ready to engage any interceptors the savages may have been mysteriously holding back from the battle. The initial pass by the Phantoms yielded little to no AA fire, as all units were engaged in fierce ground fighting in and around the target. But within 20 seconds, the interceptor leader, callsign Spitball, picked up multiple bogeys inbound from 20,000. He ordered the Phantoms to break and engage now that the bombers were nearing the strike zone. Meanwhile, the Titan leader had green lights on all bomb systems and was tracking good on the drop. Ordnance was armed, and they were standing by for weapon release.
"Sir," Titan leader's bombardier said, "I'm getting several warnings. Friendly targets in the zone."
Titan leader frowned. His bombardier was tasked with overseeing the elementary targeting software. Maybe too many different ID tags from all those coalition forces?
"Maybe, sir, but we're supposed to have them all linked into the system."
That system was a smart release ordnance safety meant to protect targets identified as friendly. Military organizations often work to maximize damage and minimize friendly fire by allowing targeting software to update in real time who was friendly and who wasn't. "Hadn't we better call it in?" asked the bombardier, surely aware of how this might scrub the run.
"Yeah," Titan leader said, switching to his wing comm to call off the attack. "Wait. It's cleared up. I've got clear locks."
Titan leader let out a heavy sigh. He switched to the wing comm.
"Watch for targeting anomalies, but be ready. Those savage interceptors are giving our Phantoms a tough time."
Ahead, fighting over the massive savage hulk, the Nest, were scores of fighters locked in winner-take-all dogfights. If any of those savage ships were able to break off and get to the Titans, Titan leader didn't want to think about what that might do to the formation. The bombardier sat watching his displays, waiting for his window to go green.
"Titan 8 bombs out," came the call over the wing comm.
The bombardier turned to look at Titan leader in the cockpit. The pilot, along with his co-pilot, met the man's gaze, concern on all three faces. It was too soon. They couldn't be over target yet. But before any of them had a chance to question it, another voice came over comm.
"Titan 6 bombs out. Titan 7 bombs out."
And so it went until the bombardier's display went green.
"Firing solution acquired, Titan leader."
"Drop 'em," replied the pilot.
Because the savages were bearing down hard, breaking away from the Phantoms and screaming toward the formation, and this bombing run was everything.
"Titan leader bombs out."
Titan 8. The last Titan in the strike had been the first to release her ordnance, dropping her explosives well behind enemy lines. Or so the ship's bombardier believed, so the ship's sensors had told him. In reality, the release devastated the rear echelon of coalition forces. The coalition's mobile TOC was vaporized, as were several supply units, along with a field-action surgical team operating close to the lines in support of combat operations. Had Titan 8's bombardier been trained in the subtleties of electronic warfare, he might have noticed that the smart release ordnance safety had suddenly reconciled by throwing friendlies much farther back than they had previously been on the grid. And had he noticed this, he would undoubtedly have questioned such a potentially disastrous shift of assets on the map. But he didn't notice, didn't question. It didn't even occur to him or to anyone in the strike that the savages had reacted to the incoming threat by changing the playing board. Effectively, they had painted friendly forces as hostiles, with devastating success. Titan 6 followed in short order, dropping 7,000 pounds of ordnance on the main element of coalition forces coming up Grand to attack the eastern edge of Triangle Square. Infantry caught in the open or sheltering behind the big Sentinels and Wolverines fighting their way through heavy anti-armor fire were blown to pieces as the first of the ground-penetrating weapons slammed into the street, sending explosive blasts rippling through the lines. More ordnance airstrikes detonated roughly five stories above the surface,
Buildings were literally blown in half and collapsed onto other neighbors or into the streets. Teams of both Coalition and Savage operators fighting for these high vantage points were instantly killed by storm fronts of flying debris. Someone running the data from Indomitable, looking past the horror of what was transpiring, estimated the main body of the Coalition assault suffered at least 90% casualties within the span of 10 seconds. Tanks were flattened or blown off like children's playthings. Blast waves of glass and molten steel spread out into other streets, killing flanking units and causing casualties as high as 50% in tertiary assault support units. Those aboard Titan VI would, perhaps mercifully, never know what they had wrought. Moments after dropping its load, Titan VI was riddled by Savage interceptor fire and crashed west of Hilltop, going up in a swirl of flames and belching black smoke that promised there were no survivors. In almost the same moment, Titan VII released both of its GBs, the immense bunker-busting weapons. GB-1 scored a direct hit after boost, penetrated deep into the subterranean levels used by the new Vega Transit Authority, and went off like the biggest firecracker short of an actual nuclear weapon. GB-2 cratered Triangle Square, killing much of the infantry fighting in the surrounding buildings, as well as supporting armor. It was worse than anyone could have possibly imagined. At least the Savages, despite their victory over the Titan targeting systems, were not free of casualties. Most of their forces operating forward of the Nest were wiped out along with their Coalition adversaries. Still, it was better for them than it could have been, by far. The Titan Strike Leader was the only ship that actually dropped on target, deploying a long line of bombs up to the Savage Colony ship set down on the eastern side of the Hilltop District. Yet the damage, while terrific, did little more than ruin streets and devastate buildings of little tactical value. It wasn't expected to do so. Their drop was a calculated precursor meant to clear the way of any hidden last resort AA emplacements that might be waiting to take down Titan V as it roared to drop the two remaining GBs on the Savage Hulk itself. Titan V was in the sights of another Savage interceptor that had managed to break through the line of defenders from the 538th Fighter Wing. The Savage fighter scored several hits on the Titan, but the big bomber managed to release one GB anyway, dropping it short, just west of the Nest and close to Hilltop. The blast collapsed an entire city block that was most likely unoccupied by Savage forces. The second GB refused to release and went down with Titan V when she crash-landed in the government district, detonating with the ship and leveling buildings from the thunderous surface explosion. And then it was all over. The surviving Titans raced to return to Mother while the Phantoms provided cover, too focused on staying alive and shooting down their opponents to notice the stunned silence coming from the command comm. Strike Force Warhammer had been reduced to combat ineffectiveness within the span of less than a minute. Chapter 35. "Sound off now," shouted the Sergeant Major over the comm in the aftermath of the series of tremendous explosions that had rocked the bank and the entire city. Some of the men of the 25th Spallurzan Light were answering, many were not. The colonel rolled over onto his side in the dust-filled stairwell. He and the kid, as he thought of Martin, had made it back inside just before the bombs began to drop. That had been an awesome sight. Seeing those 8 bat-winged bombers, among United World's most iconic war machines, sweeping in over the city at low altitude and then beginning to drop. Awesome and terrible. A holdover from the old shock and awe glory days. The colonel felt hard concrete steps underneath him, but he could see nothing, just dark. He felt for his battle board and activated the beam. Suddenly the stairwell was bathed in harsh white light, dust swirling this way and that, each moat a world, surrounded by all the worlds the galaxy had to offer. Distantly, he heard alarm bells ringing. He wondered if that was just his ears, if his eardrums had been ruptured by the massive concussion effects and barometric drops that accompanied the fabled Alpha Strike the Titans had devastated other cities and worlds with. He got to his knees and tried to stand. The stairs above the one he was lying on had been damaged, but had not collapsed fully. Cracks showed ominously in the pristine white concrete, They had almost been crushed, but he could stand. He had balance. He wasn't dizzy. His eardrums hadn't ruptured.
"Specialist Martin,"
croaked the colonel as he waved his arms through the sea of floating dust. Nothing.
"Martin!"
barked the colonel hoarsely, his voice cracking as dust swam and swam with seemingly no place to go but around him while those distant alarm bells kept ringing, as though someone would respond shortly and come to help. But he knew that would never happen. He swept his hand from side to side to clear away more dust. He saw the blood mixing and congealing with the silty dust that powdered everything like an alabaster covering. And he saw the source of the blood lying halfway down the stairs. Moving cautiously, unsure how stable everything really was, he reached the kid. Martin wasn't dead, but he'd taken a pretty good knock to the head. Maybe a concussion, maybe a fracture. The colonel sat down and thought about where he was, what the situation was. The ringing kept on, unabated. The sergeant major sounded on the comm again.
"Sound off if you're there."
Then,
"Here, Sarge. Bryans."
"Copy. Tark here. Got Sutton and Willis. Willis is hurt bad. Think his back is broke."
"Norris here. Can't find the rest of my team. 16th floor."
A few others, but nowhere near the entire team. Not at all. Martin groaned. If he threw up, it was a concussion. If he couldn't see straight, it was a fracture. Maybe. The colonel thought he'd see how good the kid did before he made an issue out of it. Then he tapped his comm.
"Mark's here. 20th. Sergeant Major, can you raise comm with Doghouse?"
Silence. Not just over comm, but everywhere out over the city. Except for those alarm bells that were still ringing in the distance. And those were always there, had always been there, in all the other wars and disasters he'd been through. Alarms crying out like they'd gone mad at the injustice of all the destruction that had suddenly come without warning. But only after the fact. Funny. You never heard them when it was rap and slap, run and gun. Only after, when you could see the dead bodies in the street. When the fighting was either over or on hold, as both sides caught their breath and prepared to come at each other once again.
That's a negative, sir, replied Andrus. No contact with higher elements at this time. Not even the ships on the net. Thinking, hoping, maybe we just have squad comms. But from what I can see of the street, sir, we might be the only ones left.
Someone had messed up, that was for sure. And the colonel had a pretty good idea who. Chapter 36. The Wild Man, near Triangle Square. He'd been firing into the savage lines along the complexes that line the opposite side of the triangle. Target-rich environment over there, to say the least. The fighting had wound up into a full-tilt, no-holds-barred battle royale for all the marbles in the moments before the Titans arrived overhead. He'd taken up a position on the 18th floor of an office building that seemed to be the kind of place he and his wife had watched in one of the entertainments, a show about beautiful and successful people, lawyers, who worked in just such an office. They were always slapping each other and then kissing. A lot of crying, too. They'd watched those. She'd liked them. It was like peeking into a different world, not the little stead they kept on the edges of Stendhal. "Do you think that's what the big cities on the top worlds are like?" she would ask him sometimes. This office he was shooting from was that kind of place. The kind of place they, those people in the entertainments, would have worked in, slapped in, kissed in, cried in, lived in. That was what the entertainments made you think life was. Slapping, kissing, and crying. In hindsight, he'd thought as he made his way with his big rifle up through the silent levels of the lifeless place, they might not have been so wrong. Maybe that was what life was supposed to be, instead of killing each other. Maybe. The wild man landed the scope on a savage hunkered in the ruin of a luxury tower across the way. The thing had some type of advanced tricky binoculars, a spotter of some sort. Sure, maybe life was something else. But not here. Not today. He blew the savage's head off, thinning the population. They'd stopped being human a long time ago. They were nothing but animals now, pure and simple. Predators come in to prey on the herds. He found another, because that's what she wanted. "You smiling, babe?" he asked the quietly carpeted, luxurious office he was firing from. A place they'd probably done all those kissing, crying, slapping things in. People who were now either dead or... He was shooting from well back near the wall against the central elevator core, almost in the hall, just picking targets out between the desks and narrow spaces that opened up onto the savage lines below and across the triangle, one after the other. Boom. 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 Like some song perpetually on the edge of beginning the backbeat, the rhythm, the chorus line, the chord change, all that stuff that would never be. Boom. He didn't even hear the bombers come streaking in over the skyline, vapor contrails rolling out aft of their howling engines. He did see one of the United World's interceptors streak down the broad main street where everyone was fighting, twin engines burning like a screaming banshee, howling like one too. That moment filled him with something. Like he wasn't alone, fighting these savages all by himself. Which was what he'd been since Stendhal, alone, fighting, killing them one at a time from range. But now, here, with UW and whoever else throwing in on this, swarming the savages together, he wasn't alone, even if they didn't know he was here helping them. He was helping them. And they were helping him to kill all the savages. All of them.
"And then what, babe? What are you going to do once they're all gone?"
"I don't know," he whispered as he sought another target.
"Go there," he thought, "where you are."
He heard the incoming Titan bombers, but he'd never witnessed the fabled machines in action, so he had no idea that the hurricane of engines rolling in from the south was about to devastate the city. He found another savage, took a breath, began to let go. Boom. This one had time to die. It knew it. It sat down, massive hole in its gut, and it looked up at the sky with its faceless helmet as the whistling sky screams from the east, far down Grand Avenue in the low quarters of New Vegas City, began to drop. No boom here, but colossal, titanic whoomps that successively hammered the world instead. It was a badly timed chorus of monster whoomps, and then the secondary explosions. They rocked the building he was in, and it felt, as he lifted his chin away from the stock of the massive rifle, that some great beast of justice, some monster as old as the galaxy itself, had had enough of humanity's galactic insanity and had finally come to dispense a verdict. Like it was walking across the planet toward all the killing at Ground Zero, intent on killing everything once and for all. The wild man always used ear protection. His rifle was like a small cannon. The ear protection always helped him to hear her in those moments after.
"Do another one, babe."
So when the first GB powered up to boost and drove itself down into the side of Hilltop District and then exploded skyward, throwing the barometric pressure all out of whack along with several blocks of buildings in every direction, well, he didn't go deaf. The glass in the office window concussed inward as the building literally bent like a dandelion stalk in a strong wind, and he began to slide down the polished floor he'd been firing from. Everything groaned, the superstructure of the building, the walls, even the air, if that was possible, and for one brief, unreal, stomach-turning, giddy second in which death seemed inevitable.
"We're here, babe. Come along now."
He was looking at the last of the afternoon sky out the same window that had moments before been staring into the savage lines across the broad street. The building had swayed that far back. He saw interceptors tearing off and away, Titans on fire and going down. One hit along her portside wing and going in, a daisy chain of explosions rising out toward that massive, almost alien colony ship, hugging the side of the hill south of the battle. Other buildings simply snapped and fell in on themselves or were blown to disintegrating bits in seconds, hurtling out across the district, Orange blossoms of fire engulfed the street below and rose up to clutch at the sides of the surviving skyscrapers. And then the wild man's office building began to swing back the other way, and he was sure, as he slid across the marble, clutching his rifle, and only the rifle, as he rolled end over end for the smashed window he was headed for, that the whole kissing, crying, slapping building would go over as he went down and out of it, falling on top of him as he went. He was sure of that, in that seeming last of all moments. Fine, he swore at the galaxy, at the savages. I hope I crush them all. That was his thought, as it felt like the building was about to go over on its side. But it didn't. It leaned, wickedly so, like it should go over, like that was inevitable and there could be no other possible outcome. But it didn't. Glass shattered and popped loose from gigantic captains of industry-sized panes. Furniture slid and whole office partitions collapsed. But it didn't go over, and he didn't slide out of it. Not quite. He got to his knees in the aftermath. Things smashed all around him, filling the floors above and below with the sounds of things falling and slamming into one another. He heard the central core columns groaning like the spars of ancient ships, as though the very fibers that kept the building upright at even this crazy angle were ready to let go and slowly bend and break one by one. Below there were explosions, but small ones. Black smoke filled the windows an instant later, puffing and breathing like the belly of some great beast from the forgotten nether of the galaxy, like something from a fairy tale meant to terrify wicked children, something that came to take away the innocent forever, something heroes fought and died for, were summoned, sent for, and called to the stage for this moment and time. There had always been a good-looking hero in the entertainments she watched. Someone not him.
Ah!
He groaned as he got to his feet.
I'm no hero.
He pulled himself along the wall into the inner parts of the building.
And I'm not dead yet, babe,
he whispered hoarsely, if only to remind himself of what was true and known. He pulled his canteen and drank as he leaned against a leaning wall, unable to remember when he had last done so. He spared a glance out the window, now facing ominously downward. Twilight was coming. The day was done, and whatever had happened out there had ruined everyone's plans.
Not dead yet,
he rasped again.
No, babe, not yet. But we're waiting. When it's time. Do another one.
When he reached the streets below, he saw the dead, or what remained of them. He saw tanks, full-size sentinels that had been tossed onto their sides like children's discarded toys. Ash rained down from above like gently falling snow. Alarms rang out from every shattered building, as though screaming at the injustice of all that had happened. Savage corpses were mixed in with the UW dead, and all the dead of all the other military units. Many of them had been burned alive or blasted into fragments that could never possibly be reassembled. He saw one savage missing its lower half, crawling through the falling ash snow, leaving a trail in the bare scrim starting to gather on the blackened street. It was crawling back toward the mothership that had brought it here. It's going home, he thought. He'd unloaded the big rifle for the treacherous trek down the building's twisted and bent stairwell. He'd slung it to crawl, hand over hand, along collapsed stairs that had become nothing but traitorous handholds, some of the shards of glass that had raked his body when the windows blew inward still lodged where they had struck. The blood had run down his arms and dripped into his eyes. The savage crawling away from him now wasn't bleeding. Not like us, but it was trailing some sort of slick, mechanical-smelling fluid. He unslung his rifle and pulled a massive round off his vest. He thumbed it into the breech as he walked toward the wounded savage. His boots raised clouds of new ash, crushed broken glass as he slowly closed the distance. Not like us. Not at all.
Do another one, babe.
He turned. She was standing there with baby on her hip, wearing that red Saturday night dress, an apron, her red hair and blue eyes always on the edge of bitter contempt and smoky lust. I can't tell if you hate me or like me, he'd once said to her early on. She'd laughed and told him there was a fine line between the two. The ash was raining down on them, but passing through like they weren't even there. And right at that moment, he just wanted to eat the barrel of his own weapon and go to where they were. But she wasn't smiling. She only smiled when he did another one. She was waiting. And that smile had been everything to him. He'd move mountains for that smile. He turned back to the crawling half-savage. The sky ripped in two as a group of starships came screaming in above the colony ship. Fast and hot, the clouds and smoke suddenly folding around them in their wakes, then flinging themselves out and away into nothing at the tremendous weight of ionic thrust. Stunned by this sudden return to reality, the wild man stared skyward with his mouth open. A fleet. A fleet is what he would have called it. Come to save New Vega. Come to smite the savage ship. All the ships high above him in the last of that fiery day bore down on the beached whale of a savage hulk that was easily more massive than them all, put together even, all of them. Missile trails, smoking and sidewinding, were already racing down to hit the stranded monster ship that had come to ruin this world. But that was their business.
Do another one, babe.
This was his. He raised the rifle and targeted the crawling savage that had been torn in half and had gone on living despite that. Dragging itself home like every wounded animal ever had since time began, trailing little bits of machine and armor and oil, little bits of itself, like no living thing. The shot rang out across the empty ruined city. Its sound echoed and bounced from one wall to the next, as though looking for one other last living survivor to believe it. And then it faded out into nothing, because it had found no one. The savage's head had disappeared in a black spray of ruined armor and misty brain, like no living thing that was ever human. He turned back to see her, to show her what he'd done for her, to see the smile. He didn't see it. She was gone. There was only that ash falling as the massive battle began in the skies above. Yet despite the end of that world, of everything, he felt her smiling. And to him, that was everything. The end of the way things were. Carrier Defiant, Task Force Wrath. Admiral Sulla was most concerned with fleet formation and positioning when they emerged from jump in the atmosphere over New Vega City. Quantum boost signal coupling had negated the early catastrophic errors that had plagued fleet ops of this type. But Sulla had been flying long enough to maintain a healthy fear of the horrors of formation jumping. And they wouldn't have done it at all were it not a micro jump. Only at short distances were these kinds of precise insertions possible. Small errors in calculation didn't expand into the major critical failures that could occur over incredible distances. In those instances, even the most remotely placed fractions of decimals could magnify to the point where ships could annihilate each other on a bad re-entry. The younger crew all about him, busy with their tasks inside the dark CIC, rushing from comms to weapons to power management and deflectors while he studied the digital sand table, seemed businesslike and heedless of what happened when two ships shifted back to real space and tried to occupy even the smallest bit of space-time in the same instant, or tried to occupy some other object that was currently where they wanted to be, like a sun or a planet, or even a small asteroid that could be pushed out of the way by the effects of the hyper-destabilization bow wave. A ship could instantly become nothing but a debris cloud expanding across the cosmic background in such a horribly miscalculated moment. And the odds increased when two massive ships like the battlecruiser Omari and the carrier Defiant, along with their escort ships, hurtled through the void of hyperspace, whatever it really was because no one really knew, together, in battle formation, ready to engage the enemy at broadsides. Marines were ready, gunners standing by. Pilots in the briefing rooms were receiving the forward scout explorer's data and receiving their strike targets on the objective. Every crew member had moved to battle station readiness. Overwhelming, highly qualified forces were closing in on a single Savage Hulk that had refused to take off. Maybe she couldn't. Who knew? But why? Wondered the Admiral as he studied the static display. No new incoming data came in while in jump. Did he have a bad feeling about all of this? In the last instant before the entire task force tumbled from hyperspace, an Atmo insert no less, the CIC suddenly grew quiet. Even the constant electronic murmur of traffic between the ships and throughout the ship's departments dropped off. And all that could be heard was the monotone voice of the fleet jump coordinator calling out the seconds until jump exit. 3, 2, 1, exit. The series of screens along the forward section of the darkened combat information center showed the view from the bridge. Admiral Sulla, like most deck officers, gave these an almost cursory and really involuntary examination. Their eyes and ears were the data being assembled all at once across the CIC. They would be far more aware of what was going on by looking at these readouts, displays, and holographic projections than by merely observing the forward bridge display screens. But their eyes were involuntarily drawn back, helplessly, to the forward view, to the apocalyptic amount of destruction in front of them. A stunned silence enveloped the bridge. The city was ruined. The Admiral barked out, "Targeting!" to refocus his dumbfounded staff and crew, to tear them away from what could not be unseen. A ruined city. Impact craters, seemingly haphazard, carved out of entire city blocks, oily smoke boiling up against a red sky, shattered towers, collapsed buildings, entire sections of the once brilliant city on fire. "Update from the Explorer," called out the TACAN officer. Her job was to update the situation from what was known pre-jump to what had transpired mid-jump to what was now the state of play post-jump. "Negative contact with Doghouse. Negative update on ground operations from Warhammer Actual. No contact there either, Admiral. Titan Leader is under attack and broadcasting bad strike on the raid. Multiple friendly casualties confirming. Explorer confirms. No damage to the nest." Stunned silence followed. They had been in hyperspace for less than a minute. How could such disaster have fallen on the Coalition in such a brief time? "Looks bad, Admiral," she finished. An apt summary. "But we have target lock on objective nest and are closing to firing range with turrets. SSM solutions are good." And now was the moment of decision for the most veteran of UW's naval officers. Go with close-range fire for the capture, identifying and targeting critical defensive systems to disable that technological relic and ancient wonder, or destroy it and save as many assets as possible on the ground in the aftermath. One scan of the real-time updates coming in from every asset's transponders, down to the infantry group level, told the Admiral that the entire mission was a catastrophic loss. "Confirm SSM use now. All ships engage at will." An electric buzz shot through the CIC, and the crew bent to the firing orders. This was, short of nuclear release, the most extreme option at his disposal. Ship-to-ship missiles rated at starship levels of hull penetration and destruction, being used in fleet fire support, would do massive damage to the city. "Instruct all units to withdraw to the stadium and stand by for evacuation." The sensor OIC was at his side. "Admiral, Explorer's detecting an inbound hyperspace disruption." The Admiral's blood froze, because this was unexpected. And there weren't any friendlies Sulla could think of who would come unannounced into a savage war zone, but an enemy. They had theorized over the years that something like that could happen, theoretically. It might. Many had said no, made solid arguments why it never would. But on a day when so many things were going wrong, then why not today? Why not now? "Scramble the interceptors," Sulla said. "Load the bombers with SSMs. We'll take no chances." The CIC shot caller was standing nearby to receive any such orders, opened his mouth in disbelief. The bombers had been loaded with anti-personnel and bunker buster munitions to mop up identified Savage holdouts and hotspots on the ground. SSMs weren't used for those operations.
Sir, it'll take 20 minutes to swap the ordnance out, he protested.
Do it faster then, said the Admiral through clenched teeth. We may not have even that much time.
The beginning of the way things would be. Coalition Fleet, the skies above New Vega. The history books would often get the Battle of New Vega wrong. The entertainments were even worse. For more than the next 1,000 years, they would get it so wrong, and in so many ways, that no one at the battle could even have recognized that these epic narratives were meant to represent the actual event. It was not fought in the middle of the day with superheroes leaping between ships. There was no love-struck couple, a junior weapons officer and an insubordinate female marine, riding the destruction down into the ruin of the savage nest planetside, sacrificing themselves to save the day. That was just something invented by storytellers to sell downloads. It was fought at dusk, and the sky looked like it was filled with strange behemoths from other worlds floating toward one another and hurling lightning bolts and smoking arrows across the sky as they closed the distance. In that, it was mythic. Epic, even. But the directors of the entertainments had wanted it to look prettier and be more visible. They changed the facts in order to earn more credits. And long afterward, when the truth had already all but been done to death in the dark ages of war to come, the stories were changed again, this time to fit the times and highlight issues to support the agendas of the now in those far-flung future viewings, disregarding the truth of the then, of that day. What the wild man witnessed from the ruined and burning streets of New Vega, and what Sergeant Greenhill saw from the unfathomable destruction in the rear echelons, and what the colonel and his strike force and any other survivors saw unfolding in the twilight darkness above them was beyond description. Everything that would come, no matter the budget and despite the special effects, would pale in comparison. What happened that day was terrible. It began with the arrival of Task Force Wrath at twilight as the city burned, like some tormenting plane in the lower hells. One Spallurzan battlecruiser, the Omari, and two defensive escorts, the Isolde and Galahad, supported by the Espanian missile frigate Campeche, led the coalition fleet's charge. To the rear and off the starboard side of that attack formation came the premier United World supercarrier Defiant, supported by Bauer and Joan d'Arc, along with three assault frigates, Moreau, Stearns, and Chang. The captain of the Omari had first strike authority and fired a full spread of SSMs, six in all, as the distance closed to less than 10,000 meters between the advance guard of the coalition and the savage hulk. Less than a minute later, both Galahad and Isolde released torpedoes and fired four SSMs apiece. Suddenly, the savage nest, an ancient colony ship built hundreds of years earlier in low Earth orbit and launched in the last days of the Big Uplift, when elite colonists fled dying Earth for the promise of some found utopia out there in the stellar dark, erupted on the ECM spectrum with a powerful directional cone of jamming noise and electronic interference that activated failsafe codes within all of the incoming missiles that formed the Coalition First Strike response. That lone pulse, powerful and immense, defeated the first wave. But sensors detected a massive surge within the colony nest's powerful reactors, and it was an Omari Takan officer's analysis that perhaps this was some type of one-shot weapon. SSM reloads were underway at 2 minutes out on the three lead ships when the Campeche was released by the Omari's commander to engage with a full broadside spread from all missile batteries. The Espanian missile frigate wasn't carrying full payload SSMs, but rather the evasive and highly agile Storms, systems targeting omni-reflex missiles. These were AI-controlled and capable of free-fire target acquisition on the fly. The Espanian captain unlimbered all batteries and launched as the ship lumbered into a hard turn to port, breaking off from the main assault at an altitude of 4,000 meters above the ruined city. The ship heeled over as missiles erupted away from all batteries along her port side, their smoking trails dancing and weaving toward their target, the Savage Nest. The ancient white-hulled hulk once must have looked daring and impressive to those who prepared to leave Earth within it. But even before the missile strike from the Campeche ravaged the outer hull, the long years in space had clearly taken their toll. The hulk was covered in cosmic dirt and maintenance grime, and ravaged by battle damage from other conflicts that had taken place somewhere along its distant travels. Strange mechanical blisters of unknown origin dotted its skin. The storms found and acquired targets identified as weapon systems, drive propulsion systems, or comm engineering structures. To the rear, as the forward three ships closed in, engaging in coordinated volley turret fire, the carrier Defiant switched to flight operations and deployed interceptors rapidly. Initial plans for the strike stated that atmospheric flight operations would begin once the Savage ground threat had been identified and neutralized, when targets could be selected during mop-up operations. Some returned battery fire, actual old-school 20mm chain guns reeling off spent casings from the Savage Hulk, engaged at max range. The weapons had little effect against the closing Omari and her powerful deflector screen and forward armor. Meanwhile, the Spallurzan battlecruiser was firing at will with a 36 heavy pulse batteries. The ancient hull of the massive Savage ship was being torn to pieces as ship-to-ship fire ripped plating to shreds and destroyed critical topside systems along the dorsal sections. It looked as though victory was at hand, and perhaps it would have been had the thing, the theory, that all others wrote off as an impossibility, hadn't come to be. Admiral Sulla overrode all comms to issue high-priority flash traffic from the Combat Information Center of Defiant. Warning to all Coalition vessels and forces, expect more Savage vessels this sector. Hyperspace destabilization detection alarm has been activated. Collectively, this was the first time such a phrase had been uttered within the consciousness of either the military or the galactic culture as it was known. The Savages did not work together. They were highly tribalized as a result of their closed floating utopias. The differing lighthuggers had been rivals on Earth, seeking to remove themselves from one another in the expansiveness of interstellar travel in order to pursue their individualistic ideals of perfect. The galactic consensus was that Savages were just as opposed to one another as they were to any civilized colony they encountered. A ripple of shock raced through Fleetcom as commanders asked for clarification, and crews struggled with the reality that the one-sided fight they'd been more than willing to participate in for glory and easy combat decorations might be turning into something far more difficult. The contingent of Rossonian Crusaders, a heavy mechanized infantry unit from Ross 241, accompanied by their diplomat as part of their agreement to submit to the Coalition leadership, threatened mutiny, immediately demanding that the captain of the Joan d'Arc terminate the engagement and withdraw safely from the battle. A similar scene played out on other Coalition ships as the fighting unfolded over the next few minutes. Two pivotal events happened within the next 30 seconds. The first would stun galactic culture, sending shockwaves through the dozen capital worlds and the smaller colonies that had begun to flourish during the early golden age of hyperspace. Four massive Savage ships fell out of hyperspace at a range of just over 10,000 meters from the nearest Coalition warship. The second was that the Savage Nest fired a swarm of drones at the Hispanian missile frigate Campeche. Thousands of ceramic-forged drones, similar to the ones used in the anti-personnel strike that had taken place earlier, shot forth at railgun speeds. A moving cone of destruction erupted down the hull of the medium-sized capital ship, as though it were a tractor suddenly consumed by a swarm of locusts on a sunny country day. The powerful drone slammed into the forward sensors, upper bridge, lower command, and intel targeting, then proceeded aft through the crew quarters all along the ship. Critical hull failure occurred when the successive drone blasts penetrated inward and hit missile stores, activating a cascade of explosions among the storm warheads that were ready racked for loading. The magazine explosion tore the vessel apart. Only the compartment block containing engineering decks survived instant destruction. It managed an immediate emergency separation operation and fired the disconnection bolts to separate from the ship. But with the vessel at 4,000 meters, deep in the planet's gravity well, there was little room for recovery or escape. The engineering section came down in the wealthy seaside district of Porto Suelo, along the coastal southern side of the hilltop district. There were no survivors. For the first time in recorded history, the savages had joined forces for a common cause. The next 1,500 years of galactic history would be defined by this moment. The Savage Wars had begun. Chapter 37. Carrier Defiant, Task Force Wrath. Watching the battle on the forward display and letting the fighter intercept officers deal with this newly arrived savage threat was all Admiral Sulla could do at the moment. The Campeche had suddenly flared and then gone up like a bomb off the Defiant's starboard bow. The crew of the carrier, men and women who'd seen countless pirates destroyed and had participated at long range in the Battle of Telai, gasped as pieces of the missile frigate went in every direction. Smoke trails erupted from the fiery blossom, rising into the atmosphere hundreds of meters before falling down to land in the vast urban sprawl of a dead city, several boroughs of which were already on fire. A senior deck officer began to cry, her sobs poignant reminders in the sudden silence that enveloped the stunned CIC that the game had just changed, and that it would be an all-in game. There would be losers and, perhaps, winners. Someday. Sulla tore himself away from the image of destruction. Redirect all sensors. We need data on those four new contacts now. Suddenly the CIC was alive once more with chatter and motion as trained professional officers forced themselves into action. It was time to start fighting this battle if there was to be a chance anyone might survive. Out there off the starboard bow, the burning wreckage of the main spine of the Campeche fell like a burning Hollow-Eve skeleton toward the city below. Not far off, the engineering section, which had disconnected at an extremely low altitude, plummeted along its own dangerous vector. "They're not going to make it," someone who was still watching called out. But Sulla had no time for that. None of them were going to make it if things kept going the way they were headed. Already a distress signal was coming in from the scout vessel Explorer in low orbit, indicating that she too was under attack. Chapter 38. 3-6 Armored Cavalry, Fast Attack, 931st Artillery Perimeter. There wasn't much left of the detachment of motorized cavalry that had been sent out at just after dawn to recon the area surrounding Objective Rio, and which had instead become a loose collection of ad hoc gun bunnies attempting to execute fire missions under the direction of the wild-eyed drug manufacturer and distributor, Private McAfee. The badly executed Titan bomb run had dropped ordnance all over the coalition rear and on some forward operating units, producing geysers of flame leading all the way up the hill. The ground shook violently for several seconds after the strike, trembling before fading at last into a dull, low-grade resonance. But none of that interrupted the detachment's work of acquire, load, and fire. Rinse and repeat. What did stop the fire missions was the sudden lack of requests coming in. They just blinked out on the fire control computer that had been set up at the center of the gun battery.
"McAfee," Sergeant Greenhill said, tapping his comm as he approached the guns. "Why aren't we being sent new targets? What's going on?"
"TOC control might be down," said the shirtless McAfee as they clustered around, dirty and sweating. "Or forward observers took a hit and all missions are offline until solution integrity can be reconfirmed. Don't know."
"Maybe they're all dead," said Kurtz,
staring at the plumes of smoke and flames rising before them as buildings pitched and fell, and savage interceptors down Titan bombers and phantoms in deadly aerial fighting.
"It looks bad, man."
"No,"
said Greenhill, shaking his head.
"That can't happen."
But then Task Force Wrath jumped into the skies above New Vegas City. A big warship and her two escorts, followed by a massive United Worlds carrier and her group.
"Don't matter now," someone shouted in that tense moment that hung between triumph and whatever the state of the actual battle was.
From back here, it didn't look like things were going too well at all. But the fleet above would change all that. They show up and the war's over. Which seemed right. A done deal, as it were. An entire task force against one savage hulk still on the ground. No contest.
All the men standing around the battery stood back to watch the lead battlecruiser engage Objective Nest. There was shouting and whoops as the powerful shipbuster SSM streaked out from the lead warship, aiming down and forward, racing in toward the defenseless target on the ground a few kilometers to the south. That was how it seemed at that moment. When the SSMs exploded before reaching their target, a few of the men groaned like naughty children whose fun had been suddenly ruined. But an ominous silence fell across the battery as they watched to see what would happen next.
"They're gonna target the nest and start firing," Greenhill mumbled to himself, almost willing it to be so. But who knew if friendly troops were that far forward? Battlefield intel had been silent for the last hour. Drones were down. They'd just been firing blind missions, trusting the coordinates and targets they'd been given.
"Oh!"
It was Kurtz who first shouted when the three massive savage hulks showed up in atmosphere.
When the survivors of the 3-6 armored cav stood witness to history. The first ship looked like a massive low mountain ringed by a wide outer plain, an upside-down city hanging underneath the mountain's gentle slope, all of it matte gray steel. That was an incredible sight. The ship on its heels was a kilometers-long tube with a central disc. A massive blister forward of the spine looked to be some kind of command and control structure. At the rear, a wide block of ancient engines thrust the long ship through the atmosphere. The third ship, almond-shaped on its top half, was constructed of the same white hypermold ceramic as the nest. Its bottom hemisphere was shelved in decks and small cities all along its massive length. Every one of these ships was a leviathan compared to the tiny coalition task force that seemed to have been dwarfed right out of existence. The massive savage hulks moved at an incredibly high rate of speed.
"That's what they gotta do to avoid smashing into the planet," thought Greenhill, who'd always found starships fascinating things.
Due to their Goliath-like size, it seemed as though they were pushing slowly through the atmosphere, forging ahead in one pass over the battlefield, but in reality, they were moving very, very fast. It was the grounded hulk that fired first, the nest. A drone swarm erupted from its hull like 100,000 ravens had suddenly taken flight. They raked the side of the Campeche, and the Hispanian frigate exploded from stem to stern. Greenhill felt as though he should give orders, get the men into vehicles, and do something. But they all just stood there rooted in fear and wonder, unable to take their eyes away from the awful spectacle playing out in the skies. The big, half-almond-shaped hulk opened up with a weapon system that was nothing like a pulse or blaster. Massive railguns spewed forth shadowy projectiles. The ghostly images of superkinetic shots rocketed forth from the bow as the ship closed in on an intercept for the lead coalition group.
4 shots in all. 1 missed. The rest broke the Spallerzan battlecruiser Omari in half.
"We in trouble," Sergeant Greenhill said.
Chapter 39. Carrier Defiant, Task Force Wrath. In the moments before the Omari was fatally holed in several critical decks, exploding at an altitude of 3,000 meters over the western edge of Hilltop, Admiral Sulla had high hopes for the Defiant's interceptor squadron now making runs against the new savage hulks. The pilots were calling in direct hits on the underbellies of the giant vessels, and one explosion, which appeared to critically affect the long, slender ship with the massive disc at its center, indicated that despite their size, these beasts could still be hurt with conventional weapons. Which was a thing that was known, but somehow also in doubt. As though the arrival of the new hulks had swept away everything once held as fact when it came to the savages. Previous engagements had shown that SSMs were sufficient to take down a savage light hugger. And even though Objective Nest had been able to jam the first strike from Omari and her escorts with a powerful electromagnetic pulse,
That didn't necessarily mean they could pull that trick all day long. The bombers on the lower hangar deck, seated in the belly of the carrier, were being reloaded with more SSMs as fast as possible. The armaments section chief was saying 8 minutes until combat drop. They would make short work of this little trick the savages were attempting to pull. Except, Admiral Sulla reasoned as he studied the tactical display, this is a trap. Doctrine indicated savages didn't work together, didn't even communicate with one another, perhaps couldn't. They were as alien to one another as they were to their distant hyperdrive relatives. But doctrines changed. And this was no lucky time jump, no. The savages had purposefully dropped a ship on New Vega, waited patiently for a coalition strike that had taken 6 weeks to get here, and then jumped in with four additional savage hulks that seemed to be working together. There was nothing accidental or lucky about any of this. Target 3 Zulu firing something, sir. 3 Zulu was the identifier that had been assigned to the half-almond-shaped savage hulk currently bearing down on the carrier.
What is it? Barked Sulla.
A second later, everyone in the CIC had a pretty good idea of exactly what the savages had developed out there, in the long dark between suns and worlds. Most definitely a railgun system, Admiral. Massive proportions, stated the matter-of-fact TACAN officer in the tense darkness of the CIC. Three shots slammed into the battle-hardened Amari and broke her in half. She erupted in such sudden fury that it seemed impossible to imagine survivors. Her burning remains plowed into a distant section of New Vega City. 2 ships in 2 minutes, thought Sulla. And so far, each savage ship had shown itself to have some kind of massive endgame offensive weapon capable of knocking out an entire ship in one strike. But different designs, each based on that savage tribe's brand of long-researched tech, suggesting that this wasn't some particularly large savage colony that had lifted off together to face the galaxy in unison. Interceptors concentrating fire on 2 Zulu. 2 Zulu was the long-spined ship with the central disc.
Stand by to jump now. Emergency escape protocols in effect on my order. Broadcast the fleet.
Sulla shouted so that there was no mistake about the order or its urgency.
Powering up jump batteries,
someone called out. No one dissented. No one questioned the decision. Rally calc locked in. Go for jump.
Recall squadrons. Negative recall,
shouted Sulla over the chaotic din developing across the command deck.
Tell them to make for the forward airfield established prior to combat operations or link up with Indomitable.
He knew some would call him a coward, but they could do that after he'd saved the carrier. No carrier meant no fighters. If the savages had to keep moving through the atmosphere to maintain altitude, then they couldn't hold the field for long, or at least so Sulla gambled. They'd have to orbit in hard atmo or climb up beyond the Lagrange to avoid the gravity well. Either way, they weren't sticking around over New Vega City unless they were intent on crash landing, which meant that by simply jumping away with what remained of the task force, Sulla could return within a few hours in order to effect rescue operations. But sticking around, that would just get his ships destroyed by whatever other superweapons the savages were keeping back for just the right moment. As of right now, it was clear they couldn't stand up to the savages' firepower. The reserve jump batteries released their energy and powered up the massive hyperdrive that would hurl Defiant from the battle. Ahead and all around, escort ships were violating protocol and leaping away before the carrier, all heading toward the emergency rally point, all desperate to save themselves now that the order to retreat had been given. Tyrus Rex had been right. The planet would need to be nuked straight into the Stone Age. It was the only way to be sure.
Chapter 40. Team Ranger, First Bank of New Vega. A massive piece of one of the destroyed starships, burning and coming apart as it fell toward the city of New Vega, barely missed smashing into the first bank the soldiers of the Spallurzan Light had been defending. The near miss rattled the building and sent the Team Ranger survivors behind cover as new waves and dust and debris flew down the streets and through shattered windows. As far as Colonel Marks knew, they were the most forward unit that day, a day now turning to night.
He watched from the massive gap where a section of the bank had been blown in. The entire building looked like a giant block of Swiss cheese now. But in testament to those early colonists who'd built it to defend their hoarded new wealth, it had held up. Out there, he could see one of the massive story's deep craters that had formed after the GB strike erupted through the city streets and down into the transit and maintenance tunnels. What remained of Grand Avenue was littered with dead savages and dead coalition troops from any number of worlds. And in an odd counterpoint to it all, the city lights had come on where they had not been destroyed, like some weird irony playing itself out now that the city had been turned into a deserted graveyard, as if declaring the war over and a return to business as usual. The bloody play was finished, and the house lights had come on. Sergeant Major Andres put a hand to his ear, listening to a flashcom transmission. "It's the porter," he said, relaying the message in real time for those who'd lost their comm abilities in the maelstrom they just survived. "Seeing all Coalition survivors got to fall back and evacuate. Assault frigate lifting off with whoever shows up. Got a little less than 2 hours." The colonel grunted. "That's 30 clicks, sir," said the sergeant major. "We won't make that nohow." They had 3 wounded and 8 men who could carry. That was all that was left of the Spallers and Light he'd cobbled together into Team Ranger. Mark shook his head, thinking.
"Try to contact the LT at Delta and tell them to move the crawlers forward to the northern edge of Hilltop. We'll try to link up.
If they're still there."
Marks nodded. "If they're still there. We might miss the porter, but they'll send in other ships to pull us out."
"Hmm," said the sergeant major, like he didn't totally believe that what was supposed to happen would actually happen, but would accept his orders nonetheless.
"Everybody else,"
Marks said, pivoting to make eye contact with his battered and bloody surviving soldiers.
"Get out the carry slings and divvy up the wounded. Martin, can you still take point? We'll move back through our lines, following streets we knew we were in control of before all the intel went down. We'll probably meet more survivors."
Specialist Martin, sitting on his helmet with a bandage wrapped around his skull, stood, wobbling slightly.
"Good to go, sir."
Everyone was injured in some way. But the seriously injured stood out. Immobile, unconscious, one battlefield amputation. It wasn't the enemy, but the explosive-propelled debris from the errant bombing strike that had done most of the damage. Marks was surveying the abandoned streets when Sergeant Major Andres joined him at his side.
"Got Delta on comm, sir.
There was a little beat up, but said they'd move on position."
"Good."
Andres looked out onto the night.
"Weird about them streetlights, huh, sir?"
He seemed to be just looking for something to say in the eerie silence that had fallen over a battlefield that only an hour ago had been turned up past 11. The lights shone down, sometimes at odd angles from those lampposts that had been bent and twisted from the ravaging fight, each one bringing into focus some grisly scene of death beneath its light. Ruined tanks, burnt or mangled men, and dead savages everywhere. Sporadic fires burned like bright flares in the night, and the smoke from the fires had made the orange streetlights misty in the early evening twilight, like something out of an ancient novel about the end of the world.
"Modern city, modern tech," replied the colonel.
"New Vega didn't need a soul alive to keep working. If all the savages and coalition forces up and left the planet forever, the city would keep up its automated rhythm